my stuff out of your way.
Presentation about where I was going.
You can say a little bit about it, and then people ask you questions, and tell you, carry you a bit apart and give you make suggestions and things.
So my paper was basically about how recently India has taken a tough stand on incremental innovations on pharmaceuticals. I don't know if people are aware of what that is. It's basically any new modified version of any existing pharmaceutical, in very simple words. That's exactly what it is. And a lot of companies, obviously, because of different advances in technology, they make modifications to the existing drugs, and they come out with new drugs, and then they've won patents for that. So India, in its law for allowing such patenting, has taken a very tough stand this year in April in a case that was going on in the Indian Supreme Court. And after that, the Indian law's interpretation of this kind of patenting is very different from the rest of the world. The rest of the world basically just follows simple, normal criterion of like obviousness and novelty to allow patenting of even these incremental innovations. But India has added an additional test which requires that any such new modification to an existing drug should have increased therapeutic efficacy. So this is something that obviously doesn't allow many things, many new modifications which are small, but may be very helpful. For example, any increase in stability of a drug or increase in bioavailability of a drug or reduction in toxicity. And the bar has been just set really high as compared to the rest of the world. So the basic aim why India was trying to do this is to prevent evergreening. And evergreening is when an existing pharmaceutical company has a drug and they have a patent on it, but the patent is about to expire. So they make a new change in the drug and in modification and try to get a patent for that. And then they will launch a new drug which is with that pharmaceutical composition, which effectively increases the patent term for them, and then they can just have a monopoly on it. Obviously, I mean, generics can still take advantage of the existing drugs that have gone off patent. But then it all becomes a factor of how the market is accepting the new drug versus the old drug, and is the new drug a lot more effective or not. So India was trying to increase the availability of the drugs at less rates to their poor population, and so that the companies don't get patents and don't have their monopoly on the new drugs, and also give a chance to their domestic generic industry to have the advantage of generic marketing of the original versions of the drug. Because if they don't give the new versions any patent, then there will be no competition for the generic company to compete with. So on the other hand, there are also many advantages that are recognized for incremental innovation in the world. As I mentioned, there is increased clinical value for these, especially, I mean, taking into account the humid and hot climates of a lot of developing countries, there are drugs that are required that have more stability, and the countries will realize only when they've made a drug and they see the effect of it in a country and they realize, okay, we need more stability for the drug to even, like, be kept in the stores for a longer time with more shelf life. So that's something that is also very helpful if India does allow this incremental innovation patenting. Also, on the one hand, they say that this will make it very affordable for the public. But on the other hand, it does reduce healthcare costs. How? Basically, if you have better dosage regimes, or if there is reduced toxicity, there will be fewer hospital visits for people, lesser amount of physician visits that are required, and the stay in the hospital is going to decrease. So effectively, the healthcare costs are going to decrease also. Also, because of the increase in the number of drugs that compete in the market space in a specific class, the new modified version as well as the older version, there is price competition that is going to take place, even at the generic center, which will reduce the prices. So there are all these different, the other side of allowing incremental innovation. So what my paper was trying to do basically was to evaluate how India can still maintain its higher stand, but reduce it just a little bit so that it allows patents for incremental innovation. And my main argument is that it can basically adopt a case-by-case approach in which it gives more weight to any drug, easily allows them to pass the test if there is therapeutic efficacy. But if there is more processability, increase in processability or increase in stability, just as the U.S. does, not by law, but just by case law in the U.S., it gives more weight to therapeutic efficacy if there is any therapeutic efficacy in a drug. But if there is just stability, it will give less weight to that property while evaluating whether it should be patented or not. So that's what my paper was basically going towards.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah.
I can only get started. So I guess the high end of the standard, the larger you raise the pharmaceutical market, I guess it is a larger incentive for people to go and add blockbuster drugs, which are typically like, I guess, foreign markets are worse than these market. Did you like see anything about the domestic industry? Yeah, I guess a lot of developing countries kind of geared their innovation towards incremental innovation, so domestic firms can rely on foreign companies to come in and they build patent a new use drug or something else for the existing patent. Does that affect anything?
Do you mean like domestic companies by their own R&D can improve on the existing blockbuster drugs? Is that what you're talking about?
For example, like Saudi Arabia or like Libya, all in Middle Eastern countries, their pharmaceutical industries rely on foreign companies to come in and patent like that blockbuster drug.
Yeah.
And then they use their own local R&D to find like a new use and then patent that existing innovation.
That's right.
Has the new patent regime in India affected domestic industries in any way?
No, I mean, effectively, this law is the same for everyone, right? So even if the generics do come up with not generics, even if a new company in India does improve on an existing drug by its own R&D, it's going to be held to the same standard. So there is nothing that's, I mean, if in an ideal world scenario, if the patent office is not biased towards an Indian company versus a U.S. company which is trying to apply for a patent, then a patent that has been filed for by a U.S. company, if it does not pass the test, even an Indian company should not be allowed to pass the test, right? So it's not like there is a difference in the fact that if you are a Indian company, you will get a patent on an incremental innovation, but if you're a U.S. company, you won't. Like, there's no such thing. So everybody is bearing the brunt of it equally.
There are a couple of things that puzzled me in both your paper and the next paper, and a lot of it was talking as if India was the world. That is, the two questions that sort of occur to me first is, why does India want to recognize patents at all, given that you would think it's a consumer made more than a producer? And the other question is, a lot of your discussion, I'm not sure if what's going on is that you're assuming that the improvements are improvements that are only important in India. Because if you're not assuming that, India's failure to grant patents doesn't mean the improvements don't get made, because they can still get made in order to be patented in the U.S. and elsewhere. So is part of this argument the idea that the kinds of incremental improvements you're interested in are mostly ones which are specific to a particular environment, and that India is a large part of that environment and therefore really is the world for those purposes?
That's correct. I mean, incremental innovations are made by companies like Novartis that are in U.S., that are in Europe, and they're going to get patents everywhere in the world. But they also have a big market in India. They would like to get the patent there, and that is the aspect that
I
was
talking about. But why does India? I understand why Novartis wants the patent in India.
Yeah.
But your argument for why India might want to grant it seems to depend on the idea that otherwise they won't get the drug. But, of course, if they don't grant the patent, but the drug gets invented anyway because other people are paying for it,
that's right,
then doesn't India get the best of both worlds?
That's true. Yeah, I mean, then the companies in India can obviously, the patent is like public, and they can obviously use that information.
So then going back, why does India recognize, what are the, because this seems to me as the sort of the hidden elephant in the room that no one seems to discuss.
I think it's because if it doesn't comply with the rest of the world's bar set on it, and it doesn't allow patents for something that the rest of the world allows, it will conflict with India's trade relations with the rest of the world, and like it is a member of WTO, so it has to comply with all those.
Have to is a little strong. There are some costs to not doing so.
I agree. But again, I'll also analyze those some clauses, the exceptions that are allowed, but this will not fit into those exceptions.
I'm not talking about exceptions. I'm saying that suppose India just says, to hell with the rest of you, we're going to do what we want.
Yeah.
Are the actual costs that other countries refuse to trade with her? Because that looks, or they don't give foreign aid, or they invade it. It looks as though somewhere invisibly in the background is some threat that other countries have over India.
I see what you're saying.
And that's relevant because according to the nature of that threat might determine what India's options are. So that one option, which you could imagine, which you sort of in a sense in a way hinted at, is India to pass exactly the laws everybody else wants, and then its courts just interpret them out of existence.
Right.
Courts are very good at doing that when they want to. Alternatively, India could pass the laws, the courts could interpret them, and India could not bother enforcing them. You could imagine a case, as happens in lots of countries at different times and places, where the black market is the real market, where everybody knows that it's illegal to buy this, but of course you can buy it.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what I was wondering reading both of these papers is why those options aren't available. What are the constraints that are... And maybe the answer is that India really wants to have patents because it wants to encourage Indian firms to make improvements.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it's also paying for them. So.
Right. I mean, India did want to increase that because obviously you know how there are a lot of technical advances that happened in India. So they want to encourage patents for that. And earlier they did not, as we know, they did not allow pharmaceutical patents. But in order to be a member of the WTO, they had to sign CRIPS, and CRIPS requires that you need to have patents for pharmaceuticals. So that's how, and right now the Indian law is all in a state of evolution. Like it's in its very nascent stages. Borrowing stuff from here and there and putting it together. So obviously it's making its own mistakes in the process and learning from that, yeah.
Let's say that graduate time last semester talked about the same exact topic, about country like India have a higher business tax standard, and her reason was that by having something like that, it encourages local development for companies in India where foreign companies would come in there and they patent everything that they possibly could give their a higher advantage to patent not only the incremental invention but the original one as well. And so by having a higher venture standard, it prevents those foreign companies from patenting a criminal invention. And domestic companies can do that without being blocked off from the patent.
But the domestic companies can't patent either, as I understand what you just told us.
Yeah, but they can still produce it, sell it, and that something that wouldn't have done otherwise by having a lower venture standard.
But that would also be true if they didn't allow a patent on the original.
Yeah, it's assuming that they can just abolish the patent.
That is this. Presumably they can or they would, in a sense. And I'm trying, the interesting puzzle that I was left with reading these is, what are the constraints?
Yeah.
You're a minister of justice for India.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very simple question. How much money should you allocate to trying to wipe out the black market and drugs that violate patent law? Why don't you say zero?
Yeah.
That's
an interesting factor to take into account. Definitely.
I mean, as you may know, there are a number of cases with regard to copyright that Taiwan, until moderately recently, maybe a couple of decades ago, didn't recognize copyright, was an open pirate nation. The U.S. in the 19th century didn't recognize British copyrights. So it's not like it's impossible for one country to violate the other country's rules, and that's...
Wouldn't that bar them from being in the WTO, though? Because I think in order to be in the WTO, you have to sign on TRIPS, and then TRIPS...
So the question is, if the reason is that they won't get favorable trade treatment, which maybe is the answer, then the question becomes, how close can they come, as it were, to abolishing patents without doing it and get away with it? I don't know the answer. See, a different question that occurs to me is, what about small countries in India's area? Because one explanation, the one you're suggesting, is that the reason they're doing it is they're being bullied into it by other countries. And that might be what's happening. A different explanation is that India is actually a very large country. It's, it's not a huge part of the world market, but it's a huge part of the world's population. So maybe of the area within which those incremental modifications matter, India really is 60% of it.
Yeah.
In which case, maybe the benefit of more innovation is worth it. The argument against the Novartis decision, the argument for what you're saying, maybe that argument is that the improvements we want won't be made unless they can make their money in India. And I don't know what's just going on, but those are sort of the questions which occurred to me. You wanted to?
Yeah, it's just a little more general, but I think the idea right now is that there's certain organizations like TRIPS or TREE that are more strict and more in favor of rights holders, and then there's organizations like WIPO, which are a little more liberalized, but they don't have as much teeth. And what they've been trying to do with WIPO is a lot of these countries that don't want to abide by these IP rules will promote this, they call it the development agenda. And then with that comes a lot of loosening of the restrictions and loosening the timetables for which if they don't get their laws into shape by then or their enforcement mechanism.
By loosening, you mean changing the terms of the TRIPS agreement?
It's just like almost like giving them special exceptions.
Giving them where? In the TRIPS treaty or?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what they're doing is bargaining for weakening the constraints on them to let them get closer to not having patents.
Yeah.
Is that what you're describing?
Yeah.
Is India one of the countries doing that?
No.
No.
So in the United States, so some of these practices like evergreening or the other paper mentioned, like their resourceful payments, the United States has kind of addressed that too with the antitrust laws. Now, whether or not that's a good idea, I don't know. But, you know, that I don't know if that would be something to explore, like with India, if that would be something. I don't know what their regulatory system is for, you know, antitrust violations. But here, there are many pending cases, and there was a Supreme Court case in June after this case, saying that it wasn't per se illegal to do that, to like do the reverse payments to delay entry of the generics into the market, but that was subject to like a different test. And so now, but there is just create a lot of ambiguity because there isn't really a, they didn't enumerate what the test was. So all these cases have gone on in remand. So would that be one possible way for India to regulate? Would be through kind of what the United States has tried to do? Or would that just be a bad, is it bad for the U.S. to be doing that at all?
Did your paper actually touch on that? I know the other paper touched on
it. I did not.
You know, but it falls into, it's also like with the isomers, like the Nexium cases, like the omeprazole and the anti-tumor esomeprazole. Those have gone to, again, this was the antitrust litigation, those have gone into that area.
That's right. I mean, it seems like there can be other mechanisms to stop entry of those kind of drugs. I mean, you can give them a patent if they pass the test, but there can be other ways to definitely.
But what you're describing doesn't seem. That it seems to me that the reverse payments raise antitrust issues. But what you're describing really doesn't. Because
yeah.
If all you're doing is patenting a new what you claim is a new drug, and that then that's I mean, you know, patent is supposed to give you a monopoly.
Well, evergreening, I think, is part. Because that's kind of like it's delaying the entry of generics into the market.
So. But evergreening seems to be a term used to apply to at least two unrelated tactics, at least from these papers, right?
Yeah, so where they're saying something like if you're making a drug, giving it like an extended release formula, making a coating or something, and then applying for that to be for a whole another 20 years of protection, that would be one.
Would that be an antitrust issue?
Some people argue it should be.
As you said, that's a big misconception that evergreening delays generic marketing. It only delays generic marketing of the modified new version. The generics can still come and compete in the market for the existing original versions that have gone off patent. So, and then, as I said, that after that, it's a matter of how the market accepts the original version versus the new version. It seems like there's a new, like, really novel advantage to using the modified version for some reason. People are going to buy that, and the generic can... generic market's going to fail for that existing drug. So it doesn't delay generic marketing as I read a lot of things and a lot of things said that, and I was like, and then I read a paper that said there was this misconception about it, and I totally agree with that. I mean, there is nothing that's stopping the original version from being marketed by generic companies.
If that's the case, why are these evergreening patents, these incremental patents, so sought after? If the generics can undercut them, why did the companies go and pursue these incremental things to extend their monopoly?
That's a great question, and that's the reason for that is the Novartis case itself. The new drug that they made was actually the blockbuster drug. Like, the new existing one wasn't that big a deal, and it was what provided them, even with just few, like, very little R&D cost, they were able to basically get a lot of money out of just a little bit. And they can get that much money. Why does a pharmaceutical company want incremental innovation? Like, what's the advantage that it gets, right? It invests just a little bit, but if the drug is a big blockbuster, they're going to get so much more money to invest into more R&D for an actual bigger, real blockbuster drug.
So the real valuable drug was the second one that was...
Yeah, Gleevec was the new drug, that the new modified drug.
Notice also that there's a certain sense in which what you're telling us suggests that the Novartis case is wrong, because if the question you ask is this really a minor improvement or a major improvement, if it's a minor improvement, then his argument would be right. If it's a minor improvement, all right, you've got a slightly better version for $90,000 and the old version for $1,000, nobody's going to buy the slightly better version. So it's only if there's a sizable difference that it matters very much whether you give a patent on the new one.
Right, and that's what I say. I mean, according to the law, the way they interpreted it, according to them, the new version, which is just a better crystalline version of the existing pharmaceutical, the existing chemical, they thought that was not high enough or like increase enough to have to pass the test, even though the rest of the world was taking full advantage of it. And
so if India was the whole world that all had this new idea, this new requirement, do you think that people would hold off on inventing something until it really was the best form, so that they don't invent something, then get barred from inventing the form that was more valuable, the incremental change that was the real good drug? Would it like back people off of patenting every little thing that they can?
There is a possibility. A lot of pharmaceutical companies are probably take a step back from the Indian market because of this law. I mean, it's in their face right now, and what do they do with it? If there is not such a big incremental advantage that people are going to get out of the drug, and they know that the Indian patent office is not going to pass their patent, then why should they even try and make a drug that would be more stable in the hot and humid climate of India?
It seems to me that there really is a factual question. If you can, you ought to investigate and add to the paper, which is how much innovations are specialized to places. That is to say, if what's going on is that the typical improved drug is 90% of its market is India,
Then
it doesn't get improved if India won't give it a patent. If the typical one, 5% of its market is India, then India, if they have any sense, should be free riding. And you ought to be able to find out something when you talk about, you're talking about in the climate of India and so forth.
I'm sure there are both kind of things, though. Like, there is nothing that will be just specifically, like, every company in the world only makes things that are...
Sure, but there surely must be market information
of
the pharmaceuticals out there. How many of them, it isn't just India, but how many of them have a very regional, you know, there must be some diseases that are common in some countries and not in others, and therefore, for those diseases, those countries are the world, so to speak. And that would seem to be an interesting way that sort of lawyers don't usually think about, but of pushing your argument to see if you can find a little data on that and therefore see is India really shooting itself in the foot, or are they just cleverly getting other people to pay for the drugs that they can use?
Yeah.
I had a question about the earlier statement you made about there's less incentive for pharmaceutical companies to patent for incremental information. That paper, does that discuss like new use patents, for example, if a drug apparently has a blockbuster and they your R&D to figure out a new use for that same drug and turns into a method patent? I was always under the impression that turned the patent instead of a shield, which is into a sword now, broadens the scope of the claim, and that is something that they can prevent people from entering the market or litigation for.
And you're saying that if it was a not a product patent, but a process patent, then it could actually encompass a lot more?
That was under the question that like, that was one of the larger incentives of incremental innovation in pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible, but like, as you would know, recently, India has made the change that it has allowed pharmaceutical patents for products, right? I mean, methods, it wasn't like that big a deal earlier, but for product patents, and this entire thing was about the product patents. So I'm sure there's a way that if you have the process patent for that, it would be able to encompass a lot more things and bar them from entering the market.
There's something which I actually mentioned in my comments to your paper, but that you, I think, ought to look at, because it's, in a sense, the same issue in a different context, and that's that there is a point in which the Pure Food and Drug Act was amended in the U.S. in a way that's really analogous to your increased therapeutic value. And essentially, it said that for a drug to be approved, it had to not only be safe, but also be shown to be a significant improvement over what was already on the market.
Right.
And an economist called Sam Peltzman did a statistical study of the effects of that legislation. And he tried, the claim was being made that drug companies are bringing out new drugs that were no better than the old drugs, just to sort of fool people into using them. And so Peltzman asked, how could we figure out, how can we measure the quality of drugs coming on the market? And he had a couple of measures. One of them was what happens to sales over time. The idea is you bring out a new drug, people initially think it's an improvement, but the doctors are going to have experience, and over years, if it's really no better, its sales will decline, whereas it's better, they'll go up. A different one is you look at expert purchasers of hospitals and such, and you see, presumably the hospitals ought to know, so if you brought out an expensive new drug and it's no better, they won't buy it. So he tried to measure the question, how did these amendments change the quality of drugs? And how did they change the rate at which new drugs were brought to market? Because it was an additional expense, obviously, to bring a drug to market. And his conclusion was there was no effect at all on quality, and that the rate of introduction of new drugs was kind of half. So if he's right, it was a very striking case of the attempt to require improved efficacy having very bad effects. Now, I haven't followed the literature since it was sort of a classic article at the time, but it was sort of really neat to have statistical measures of these things. But I think you ought to at least look at it. Footnote it, you might find it relevant to what you're saying. Do other people have other comments on this paper?
The one thing that I would have went into a little bit more in your paper is the TRIPS agreements with the compulsory licensing that they do with foreign patents and compulsory license it to generic pharmaceutical companies located in India. It's a little bit of they're favoring their own nationals, which seems to be in contrary to the TRIPS agreement, which is giving everybody equal rights. And the other thing that I might want to go into a little bit more was the price caps. If they were in new patents that they're issuing, some of the things that they're doing is they're actually issuing price caps on how much they can charge.
Who is they?
The Indian government. So the government is actually forcing existing foreign patents to license to generic manufacturers in order to provide that drug to Indian citizens.
Only Indian citizens? You were mentioning Africa, that India exported to Africa, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if the compulsory licensing applies foreignly or just to their own nationals. And then they're also price capping some of the new patents that they are issuing. So I thought those two things were interesting you might want to talk about.
Other?
So, just to clarify, were you saying that the India's policy has resulted in like a decrease in the research and development for generic drugs in general? And are you arguing then that would be like an argument for that patents really do, you know, create innovation? That they're necessary?
Well, I mean, this just happened this year, so we don't really know the effect that it's going to have in real time. I mean, we can only speculate that it will allow generics to take over any drug that's going off patent, and there will be nothing new after that. So it will definitely, as the Indian government is trying to claim, it will increase generic companies' marketing and improve that, and maybe make the drugs more affordable. But as I said, there is another side to the coin, and there are critics who say that it may not. And the other, if it does allow incremental innovation, that may still do the same thing for both things. Like, it will still increase generic marketing and it will still make the prices low.
I mean, before India was, you know, a member of the WTO and on signing up the TRIPS agreement, was that a real problem with them being able to produce their own drugs? Because people weren't investing.
That's right. I mean, that is definitely a problem. People don't invest in R&D, I mean, mostly the market in India for pharmaceuticals is generic market, generic industry. That's not a hidden fact.
One other thing I was wondering about is what you knew about the internal politics in India. That if you think about any IP case,
mm-hmm.
there's a certain sense in which within the country there's a conflict between the people who have IP they want protected and the people who want to use or buy that IP. And I was wondering, in the India case, I gather that India, that some of your generic manufacturers aren't just, if I understood your paper correctly, there are Indian firms that are doing their own improvements and we're getting them patented prior to this, to the change in the law or not?
For their own improvements?
Yes.
Prior to the law? No, they were not. I mean.
So.
They don't have enough resources to do that. I mean, somewhere or the other, maybe they can make a small change if they have enough R&D for that, but I can actually count the number of companies on my fingertips, like how many of them can actually invest in that.
So you think that, in fact, not only the original drugs, but the improvements as well are all being made by foreign companies. So
mostly,
the only Indian
yes.
market is for out-of-patent generics.
Mostly. That's what the
mostly.
Understanding is right now.
Mostly,
for,
that's
yeah,
right.
Mostly.
So in that case, there it makes sense then that the only Indian companies that are interested would want the narrowest possible patent protection.
Right.
I was just trying to see if
yeah.
there's an internal conflict.
And
in
that's
India.
What the government was, the judge was taking into
with
account when, yeah, exactly.
It's interesting.
I don't think it's a step back towards less patent protection. I mean, they're still giving patents for pharmaceuticals that are new. It's only, I mean, the law is, this test is only constrained to modifications to known substances. So to start with, if the substance is unknown, then it will get a patent if it passes the other test. So it's not a step back from that. It's just an additional test that's imposed on anything that's a modification of a known substance that was either patented or unpatented.
Alright. Before we go on to the next paper, which overlaps this to some, which is why I covered it, but is also largely on something else, I just wanted to raise a couple of related points, which really have to do with the question of, are there better solutions to the problem of drugs in poor countries? That if you think about the logic of the situation, imagine a drug which costs a whole lot of money to develop, but not much money to produce. And ideally, if you're sort of a benevolent social planner looking down at the world, you would say, they should develop it. Maybe they should charge the rich people for the cost of developing it. Then they should sell it really cheaply, say at manufacturing cost to all the poor people. Doesn't cost them anything. They're covering their manufacturing cost. And that would do a lot of good. And then the question is, are there any realistic ways you can get that result? And the fundamental problem is resale. That is, the fundamental problem is, imagine that you're a drug company and you've got a drug which you are able to get $90,000 a year from well-off people or their insurance companies in the U.S. for, and the drug only costs you $1,000 a year to produce. You would be delighted if there was some way of finding all of those people in the world who can't possibly pay $90,000 and getting them to pay you $2,000 instead. All right? That would be a gain for you as well as for them. The reason you can't do it, I think, is that you're afraid that if you do that, people in those countries will buy it at $2,000 and resell it at $10,000 in the U.S., and then you won't get your $90,000 from the rich customers. Does that make sense?
Isn't that similar to how, like, initially Americans didn't have a form of a copyright protection? Because they isn't it kind of analogous where, like, we want to develop some sort of innovation in a certain area, and then they, like, loosen the protection of innovation, and then I feel like it's, like, almost analogous to what's going on in India right now, because they're trying to increase the innovation within the Indian.
They're not trying to increase the innovation, they're trying to increase the ability to use existing innovation and hope not to decrease innovation too much in the process, if I understand the story. But what I was thinking about, forget for a moment India's production at all, because it's a more general issue. Suppose you just say, I wish the world were a better place. It would be nice if sick people got cured. Are there mechanisms by which you could make drugs much more available to people in poor countries? And as I say, if you're looking at it from the manufacturer's standpoint, they'd be happy to do it, I think, if there was no resale, because they could make more money, not less money. All right? It doesn't do them any good when somebody doesn't buy their drug because it's too expensive. They don't want to sell below production costs, obviously. And then one way you could imagine doing that, and I'm not sure there's any is if there's some way of enforcing rules against resale. Because you get, if you think about the copyright context, You get books which are printed which say not valid for sale outside the UK or outside the US occasionally. You also get books which are tailored to one country or another. You get the attempt with video players to have region codes. All right. So there are various ways in which producers try more or less successfully to make sure that this product that's sold there doesn't get resold here. And then the question is, are there ways you could do it with drugs? And I don't know very much about drugs, but several of you obviously do. So can you think of plausible ways in which the manufacturer of some drug for which the optimal price to sell it in the U.S. is $50,000 and the optimal price to sell it in India is $3,000 and the optimal price in Africa is $1,000 could do those things? Yeah.
I mean, I think the point that she was trying to get across was that it seems like it's the exact same fact pattern as the copyright issue in the first sale doctrine. Where those kids were buying cheaper books in the Philippines.
Right.
And the U.S. changed the first sale doctrine.
Right.
Copyright was friends with importing
right.
the books in here. So, I mean, on a theoretical point of view, you just change the first sale doctrine or implement it for one.
So one answer would be legal changes, which makes it illegal to import. But the question is, how enforceable are those? And maybe the answer is that because the medical industry is a heavily regulated industry, you could enforce them in sense of saying that the doctor is not allowed to give you your drug unless it comes in the container that says intended for sale in the U.S. There surely be some leakage. There always is. So I'm just thinking, trying to think sort of outside the box of the present system. It seems to me that one possible way would be to find better ways of enforcing price discrimination and then making it in the interest of the pharmaceutical companies themselves to try to get some money out of the low. Now, they're still not going to want us to ever make the drug available at less than production cost, but they can make it available at much less than the cost that they want to charge for you.
Well, isn't that only when the company has a monopoly?
Yes.
That just goes away with time.
Yeah, but by that time it's no longer the best drug. Someone else has invented a better drug, hopefully. Then I'm considering the monopoly situation.
When
no.
You have, when you have alternatives to a certain drug, price yeah. still be lower.
Yeah, sure. If a drug isn't patented, the issue I'm describing doesn't exist. I guess it would exist if for some reason it was a trade secret or something. But normally, for ordinary products, you can't hold price much above manufacturing costs as you do somebody else will compete it down. So the puzzle is, in the case of patented drugs, if you want to keep using the patents to give an incentive to create the drug in the first place, but you want to do it in a way which keeps the incentive but makes the drug available at a much lower cost to people who can't afford the higher cost. Is there a way of doing it? And I'm suggesting that one way you could imagine doing that would be by making price discrimination, by making regional price discrimination easier. Make sense or not?
So if I think between the antitrust law passed, I'm thinking that stuff.
Yes, right. Other? Yep.
I see your point, but in some senses, that way you're equating pharmaceuticals to books. I mean, one, R&D costs are drastically different for both. And two, the markets are very different. A drug that's aimed at malaria will not have enough market in the U.S., whereas we'll have a lot of market in those countries that want it to be sold at lower
right.
costs. So would that company be still able to cover up the cost that it's spent on something?
Well, if the price that covers the cost is a price people in India can't pay, and if India is the only market, it's never going to be able to make money making that drug.
Right.
But the argument is only, I was really considering the case of a drug which had a which had markets in both high-income and low-income countries. And trying to see how to, for the low-income countries, unless you subsidize it, you're not going to get it at a cost that doesn't, on average, it doesn't cover costs pretty clearly. Let me suggest an entirely different approach to doing exactly the same thing, which goes back to this business about improved drugs. Suppose you are a charity. Suppose you're Bill Gates or the equivalent. So you're a charity with quite a lot of money, but not an infinite amount of money. And you want to make the world better. One thing you might consider doing is buying the second best drugs patent and then public domaining. All right? Suppose we've got this case where what was the cutting edge drug 5 years ago. And now there's a better version. Well, the company with the better version isn't making very much money out of the previous version. Making some money, but not a lot. So if somebody raises the money and goes to that company and says, we want to buy your second best drug, the patent of that drug, which we are then going to public domain. Anybody can make it. So we're going to spend $123 million, which is a lot of money, but there are people who have money on that scale. And we're going to do a huge amount of good, because it's true, it'd be very nice if the poor people had the best drug, but the second best drug is enormously better than nothing, and it'll be really cheap once it's public domain. So that struck me as another interesting approach, and the part of the attraction of both of these approaches is that they increase rather than decreasing the incentive to invent drugs. Because from the stand, in the price discrimination one, you're making more money, not less money than before. And in this version, we're saying, well, in addition to being able to make lots of money off your cutting-edge drug, we're also giving you a little bit extra sweetener because your drug that's not making much money. Now, there's going to be the problem, of course, that they're going to be a little worried that the market for their cutting-edge drug is going to go down when the other one is cheap. But if it's really the case that the cutting-edge one is noticeably better, so the people who can afford it are going to buy it anyway, so it's really, you can almost think of it as price discrimination. Think of it as like hardcover versus paperback books, in a sense. It's analogous for that. Yo?
What happens if the cutting-edge drug practiced a lot of the claims of the original drug? In the public domain, that original drug, wouldn't that affect the
No. Now, I'm assuming that I don't think so. That is all it's got its own patent, doesn't it? Is there any reason why I can't
Are you assuming incremental innovation isn't patented then?
No, I'm assuming incremental innovation is patented, but the incremental innovation has its own patent. I wouldn't have supposed, I'm not a patent attorney, and some of you people probably are, but I wouldn't have supposed that the fact that we publicly take the case that you the Novartis case. If for some bizarre reason Novartis had let the patent on, had released the patent on the first drug into the public domain, I don't think that affects their ability to get the patent on the second drug. Because after all, the only way the first drug affects the patent and the second drug is it makes it obvious, but it does that whether it's in the public domain or not, because the knowledge is public domain, right? That's sort of part of the point of the patent system. So I don't think that's right, though I could be mistaken. Anyway, those just occurred to me thinking about it as two interesting different ways. Because it really, I mean, it seems on the one hand dreadful that you've got people dying when not only could they be saved, but they could be saved at a price they'd be willing to pay. If you imagine the case where the marginal cost of the drug is low, it's just the research cost that's high. The research cost doesn't go up when another person uses it, right? And at the same time, you don't want a system which is going to undercut a process that's been giving us a lot of sizable improvements in medicine. And so that was why I was thinking of those as possible things. Any comment? All right. Why don't we have the next paper then, which is overlaps just a little bit, but is sizably on some other things. Actually, this goes here.
Okay. So as the professor mentioned, there was a bit of overlap on this paper, so I'll try to leave out some of the overlapping details and try to focus my presentation a little bit. And the way I want to do that, I apologize for the papers. There are some disjointed ideas floating around, so this draft was not the best, but I'll try to focus the presentation a little bit more. I come from the perspective of a biochemist, actually, so I think what's really critical in this case is to understand what the court's actually grappling with. We're talking about a small molecule drug here, and what it ultimately comes down to is, you know, the question of whether a new crystallized form of the drug, a new crystal form, which is more bioavailable. I think they achieved 30% improved bioavailability, is truly inventive. And so,
for all of us non-biologists in the audience, tell us what bioavailability means.
Sure, yeah.
So I should say one of the problems I've got with a number of the papers is that the people are talking about something in an area they know something about and aren't sufficiently allowing for the rest of the world doesn't. And I have the same problem and stuff I do as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's worth all of you when you're sort of thinking about revising your paper, not that you have to, you know, give every possible detail, but if you're using a technical term which only 1% of the universe knows about, explain what it means.
Sure. I think in this case, I'd like to, it's important to focus on the actual scientific nitty-gritty. So bioavailability refers to basically when you take a drug and you take it into your small intestine, it's going to encounter a bag of enzymes in the low pH environment, and the process of the drug basically dissolving in your gut to transfusing into your bloodstream by encountering all these different enzymes, basically can be measured. We can say, oh, this is the rate of absorption. And then we can talk about all the, you know, the things that happen. Oh, we might have some sort of immune response, blah, blah, blah. But bioavailability means how quickly you take it into your body and then, you know, have it disseminated into your bloodstream.
How quickly or how much of it do you get?
The rate. It refers to the rate, I believe. I might be wrong here. But I think it's, yeah, basically how quickly can that drug access the receptor or the target that it's trying to get to. Am I wrong? I think that's right. It's the rate, right? It's a kinetic measurement. And in this case, we're talking about the exact same drug, so the exact same small molecule compound, basically crystallized in a new porous form, so a crystal with bigger pores, essentially. So if you're looking at the drug with a microscope, there would be bigger pores, and so the enzymes can access all the stuff inside the pores faster, basically. And it's all about surface area, so that's the stomach does that itself. It has lots of surface area to access the food you eat, etc. So the question in this case that the patent court was facing, and India, of course, is developing their patent system. It's thought that they will be similar to the EPO. And so today I sort of want to, in a more detailed fashion and bring in some of the details of the science, explore what we think the system will look like and whether, based on the context that we've been discussing, whether we think that tooling with certain requirements, in this case Section 103 obviousness requirements, are basically a good idea. So just to begin, to just give you some facts here, India is also a big exporter. $10 billion worth of generic medicines are exported each year, and they also produce a huge number of the AIDS drugs supplying Africa. So I have some figure that said 80%, although unsubstantiated at this point as to where that came from. Lost it. So obviously there's a big need for low-cost drugs in Africa, and often that price point is the critical deciding factor as to whether that drug gets out there. So I think, you know, and to answer one of your prior questions, I think one of the reasons they do want to develop a patent system as opposed to throwing it out the window is in the future they will be exporting even more. That $10 billion will grow, and perhaps someday they will be, you know, the hub of production.
But are you talking about exporting generics, which doesn't need a patent system? Mm-hmm. Or are you talking about developing their own new drugs? Those are different issues.
I meant developing their own new drugs, which, of course, requires those institutions that we have in the United States. But that's just an interesting fact to consider. In this case, the price hit to Gleevec, which was the drug that was under issue, would basically would go from $70,000 per year to $2,500 per year in generic form if they were not allowed to extend this patent, which, of course, in the end they said, no, this new crystallized form is not inventive. And thereby sort of lending insight into what we think they're...
Now, isn't the crystallized form then covered by the patent on the previous form? So your price change isn't going to happen for another 18 years.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's correct, yeah. Yeah. So basically, you have 10 elements, you know, A, B, C, D, E. If your new invention, which, say, has you know, it's a derivative or it has an improved crystallization, it will be covered by, as long as it contains all of those elements in the same arrangement. So, yeah, you're right about that. So the other side of the story, of course, Novartis is an American company. Is in the States, we're also facing what's called the patent cliff and major hits to you know, development. I have a figure here. Annual drugs approved for marketing declined from 53 new drugs in 96 to 39 in 2012. New drug revenue has failed to counterbalance this fall. 800 generic applications in 2011, and basically the field is experiencing a significant sales loss. And for anyone who's looking for a job right now, you can feel that on the in the life science arena, that pharma is shifting its tactics to focus more on small molecule compounds. So we are facing.
Is this the U.S. or the world?
The U.S.
What I'm wondering is maybe what's happening is that the industry is already moving out of the U.S. Can you tell if that's going on?
Absolutely, yeah. So in this case, so Gleevec is a small molecule. Basically today, all in academic labs, all synthetic organic chemistry, because it's being outsourced, is basically shutting down. Funding is shutting down, and that's because just the process of making a small molecule compound is It's an iterative process that can be basically, you know, is amenable to outsourcing. Whereas, and the paper also talks about this act called the BPCIA, which is a new, basically Hatch-Waxman-esque statute to address biologic compounds. And biologics, which like represent modern medicine and everything that we're learning that's new, are consequently much more difficult to develop. I think it costs $1 billion on average to develop a biologic. And, you know, for that reason, they need even more revenue. So the question from the U.S. side is, well, hey, we really need this revenue. And so the question I would pose for to the class is, you know, do those counterbalancing incentives...
Can you explain us the difference between a small molecule and a biologic?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. So a small molecule... is just basically what it sounds like. It's a, you know, it's a bag of atoms, 100 atoms, and let's see here. So so for anyone who knows chemistry, they know this. I'm missing a bunch of bonds and stuff, but let's say that's a small molecule. And if I'm an organic chemist, who, you know, we basically found that we have this compound will kill a cancer cell. The first step is to say, well, what's the structure? And they take what's called a NMR, a nuclear magnetic resonance image, or a bunch of different structural things they can do. And they say, okay, this is the structure. And if I'm an expert organic chemist, I can say, oh, well, I can start with this starting compound that I know about and use a strong base to add this piece. And organic chemists, they publish all kinds of papers like crazy because they always have results. They'll tweak the acid conditions, and then they take a new NMR and they say, hey, I got a new compound, and this is a derivative that's probably patentable, and should allow us to extend our patent. But a biologic, as the name suggests, is usually transcribed in a transcription reaction. Basically, a transcription reaction involves a bacterial vector, like E. coli, and we can insert the sequence for the eventual protein that we want to make. Biologics are generally protein and DNA therapeutics that are used as drugs. So we figure out the sequence of the big globular protein we want to make. We can plug it in here and use a bacteria to... make the protein, and then we have to put it through a bunch of purification steps that are tricky and never work.
So the difference is, let me just tell you, the first difference is that you're doing it not by chemical synthesis, but by a process which is hijacking living organisms to do your synthesis for you.
Correct.
And is the second difference that it's a much larger and more complicated molecule?
That would be a better synopsis, yes.
So those seem to be the two features of the biologic.
Yes. And as a result of being just bigger and more complicated, your purifications and every question you want to ask is greatly complicated. And in fact, these things will fold, they evolve to fold into multiple different forms. So when you get into, in the paper I talk about BPCIA and the requirements for follow-on biosimilars. So, generics of biologic compounds. And
are your biosimilars generics or not? That was never clear to me.
Yes, they are. They are the generic form of the
rep. A generic drug is chemically identical to the drug it's generic of. Biosimilar sounds, though, it's not identical.
That's exactly the point. You're supposed to demonstrate equivalence or interchangeability, which has these various factors, which are very difficult to meet. And that was sort of the thrust of the
thing. But what does it mean?
What does it mean?
What does biosimilar mean? I think I know uh-huh. what it means when you say that their version of acetylsalicylic acid is the same thing as Bayer's version.
Yeah.
But what does it mean to say that your biologic is a biosimilar to someone who's the patented one?
It's just a word that means a generic biologic compound. So we would just say biologic if we discovered it. We call it a biosimilar if we can demonstrate certain factors. And you're asking what those factors are.
Or at least can you give a non-technical explanation of what they're about?
I think it means, and I had this somewhere in the paper, but therapeutic equivalency. So you take it and it has a similar kinetics. So it demonstrates its phenotype or whatever it does on a similar time scale. And it is put through, you know, the same, basically, synthetic steps to create it, I think. That's somewhere in here. I don't know, does anyone else remember?
So the real answer is that you don't know because you're not a lawyer specializing in that. Yeah.
Would it be something like you use, like, a different method or... Like, it would still be the same kind of kinetics and the same kind of protein that's being made from the sequence.
But is it literally the same? Do you believe that if you had a good enough microscope...
Right.
To get the atom-by-atom picture,
mm-hmm.
Is it theoretically the case that the biosimilar is the same protein?
Sure, yeah, with a bunch of, a huge bag of caveats, you know, meaning basically if you're, I'm company B, just for example in this first step we use an enzyme to read the DNA, right? So this enzyme that you've been using, you're necessarily evolving in the lab as you use it. It changes and mutates. Company B is also trying to use an enzyme similar to that, but it will make what's called post-transcriptional modifications. It'll make small covalent changes to the protein that will sometimes drastically affect its folding.
So the biosimilar is not the same molecule.
It's very. My point is, it's very difficult, very very difficult to demonstrate true interchangeability.
Interchangeability sounds to me like a mushy word.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what it means to say the two things are the same molecule. Uh-huh. I understand what it means to say they are the same molecule structurally folded differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell whether your biosimilar means that you believe it is one of those things or whether it is a weaker test than that.
The first thing is what I believe, I think.
You believe it is structurally the same molecule.
Yeah,
all
that's
the bonds
the
are the same, all the atoms are the same, that's but it might have folded differently.
That's the idea, but it's very difficult to achieve that practically. But that's what you're supposed
wait
to
wait a minute. Is what's difficult to achieve making something of which that's true or showing that that's true?
Showing that that's true, yeah.
So the theory of this is that the biosimilar is the same molecule,
mm-hmm.
but there are difficulties in proving it is the same molecule.
Correct, correct.
Now we know a little bit more. I'm sorry.
So basically with regard to the Novartis case, I wanted to sort of to ask the question, where do we think the Indian Supreme Court is going here with respect to patentability criteria? Because most people think that India will be like the EPO, basically, where basically there are three major requirements for patentability. One, that it's novel, like the United States. Two, that it's non-obvious, and the EPO's word for that is inventive step. And three, that it's useful. It's a utility requirement in the United States. In the EPO, it's capable of industrial application. So the thought is that India will probably be similar to the EPO based on what they've released so far in their patent guidelines. But this Novartis case was an important case to sort of see, how are they going to tweak these standards to meet the demands of their patients and their developing country. So it looks like basically 101 and 102 novelty obviousness will not be very different, but this case suggests that 103 will create a new little tweak for drugs and biologic compounds. So basically, if we were to make a drug, either a drug or a biologic, and try to get a patent on it, it would go through 102, if it satisfied 102 and 101, which are pretty low bars, it would get to 103, which is the most difficult test. And in both the EPO and USPTO systems, the first question is, what is the scope and content of the prior art? The second question is, what is the skill, the ordinary skill of the person in the art? Third question is, what are the differences between those pieces of prior art we've identified and the this invention. Number four is the question of obviousness, right? So in that number three step, where we diverge basically from the EPO is there's a new, basically the EPO says, they say, identify the problem your new invention, in this case a new crystallized form, is going to address. And what is the solution? Does the solution that you've brought here, does that address the problem? So there are semantics, and then it looks like in India, in the case of drugs, that solution step, that last step, might have some little tweaks. So for drugs, the solution to that last step must involve therapeutic healing, not just advantageous properties. And so I'll try to take
Well, we've already been told through all of this from the previous thing, I think.
Yes, we have.
Tell us what's in your paper that's not in our
paper.
Okay,
yeah. And so I'll wrap up with, and what I'm bringing to this is, the details of the science here. So In this case,
but your paper is also talking about what seemed to be an unrelated set of issues having to do with U.S. law.
The BBCIA, yeah, yeah. I mean, I could address that as well.
Sure.
So in this case, as I sort of opened, we're dealing with a small molecule like this, which basically crystallized in a new form. So identical molecule, you haven't covalently changed it. It's the exact same thing. It's just more bioavailable. And so basically just to summarize what the Indian court said, they basically said, no, we're going to raise the standard for inventiveness, and basically you have to, it can't just be an advantage, it has to actually change the efficacy. So it has some phenotypic difference in the results on the patient. Okay, so to talk about the BPCIA a little bit, my basic conclusion was that...
First tell us what it is.
Okay. The BPCIA is an act that basically mimics the HWA, which was an act that provided for an abbreviated pathway for small molecule compounds. The BPCIA is providing for an abbreviated pathway
through what? Through patent or through FDA approval?
Through patent. Through patent approval, yeah. So basically, the BPCIA, in the case of the HWA, they provided basically, and this addresses generics, an accelerated pathway. In the BPCIA...
Accelerated pathway for what? Generics don't need patents.
An accelerated pathway to approval for small molecule compounds, basically.
For FDA or for patent?
For FDA.
You just said patent.
Did I just say, oh, sorry. I'm sorry.
So Hatch-Waxman Act was an accelerated pathway for getting FDA approval for a drug which purported to be the same as an already approved drug. Is that a correct statement?
Correct. And so the BPCIA is similar, and what I tried to touch on in the paper was the fact that they extended the protections for biologics. And my argument was, well, look how complicated...
Extended what protection?
They extended the exclusivity protection, too.
What is the exclusivity protection?
The exclusivity protection allows, once that new biologic is on the market, basically exclusivity to restrict other people from making and using your new compound.
All right. I thought you were talking about data exclusivity in the paper.
I'm obviously confusing myself because I haven't...
Because it wasn't clear to me whether that is what it looked as though you were talking about when I read the paper, and maybe I misunderstood it, was under what circumstances the new compound, the quote generic, which is not exactly generic in your biologics, I think, could use the data that had been used to get approval for the old compound in order to get FDA approval. And that's not a patent issue at all.
Right. Yeah, no, that's correct. Yeah. So
exclusivity normally means under what circumstances can the patent company with a patent say you can't sell that because you're violating my patent.
Right.
That's wholly different from the question under what circumstances can their data be used to get FDA approval.
So we're talking about data exclusivity, I'm sorry.
I think you are.
Yes, we're talking about data exclusivity, so access to that original data. But my basic conclusion was that, well, it takes $1 billion on average to develop a biologic compound. And some of these new requirements of the BPCA, including this interchangeability requirement, that you demonstrate your drug is interchangeable with its reference compound.
What does that mean?
That's what we talked about before.
All right.
is basically, there are some critics saying, well, 12 years is too long.
12 years for what? What is the
data exclusivity period?
So it's still not clear to me what the BPCA does. It says that I have a patented drug which has gotten FDA approval. Mm-hmm. Does it matter whether it's patented at all?
The reference drug? Yes.
Yeah. So I have a patented drug which has FDA approval. Mm-hmm. And the patent has expired?
The patent has expired on the reference drug.
And you have another drug, which you claim is biosimilar to my drug.
Mm-hmm.
And now, what do I have 12 years? What is that 12-year time limit?
I'm sort of forgetting a lot of the important details, unfortunately, but I believe that 12 years refers to the new follow-on biologic company. And 12 sounds too long for some reason, but they have access to that data of the company won't be released to other generic manufacturers.
Wait a minute. There's a second generic that somehow has, there's a second manufacturer who somehow has a special right that the third manufacturer doesn't.
I'm sorry. I prepared for the Novartis stock today, and I should have inspected the details a little bit more carefully.
I thought what you said in your paper was your paper was really about this stuff, although you opened with the Novartis. Maybe you can tell me something else, which is what all of this has to do with the Obamacare Supreme Court decision, which you seem to think is also connected with the with this act, and I don't know what the connection is, and you never told us in the paper what the connection was.
I think basically the Affordable Health Act ratified the BPCA. BPCIA, somehow it was tacked on.
Yes, because you don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't really
you
know.
Find out before you do the final draft of that paper.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions?
You can, yeah.
I guess it was kind of like what I proposed to her earlier. So about like the reverse pivot. So do you think, like, to what extent do you think that the American law has addressed these problems with like antitrust law? And do you think that's something that is appropriate? Is that inappropriate? Is that a good mechanism for regulating?
That's the one part of the Novartis thing that you had and she didn't.
Right.
Was the reverse payment discussion of greening, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And so her question is relevant to that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I mentioned briefly, basically the reverse payment scheme, for those who didn't see the papers, basically where two generics agree among themselves to delay entry in return for payment, basically from...
Two generics?
Two or three or more than one. Right?
Why can't it just be one?
It can be one. It can be more than one, too.
So what's going on is that you've got a company which had a patent.
Mm-hmm.
The patent has expired.
Mm-hmm.
And that company is paying some other companies to agree not to produce a generic version.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. And what are the grounds on which this isn't a violation of antitrust laws? That's your question.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a good question. I think in general, it may be grounds for antitrust violations.
Do you think it's problematic? There's an overlap here with patent, because on one you see patent as being a grant of exclusive rights that creates monopoly power, but then antitrust is the opposite. You're supposed to be avoiding.
But the patent has expired in this case, right?
Well, this is a mechanism for the reverse payments and stuff. It's a mechanism to keep their drug on the market longer and to delay.
But before or after the patent is expired?
They never actually litigate the validity of the patent.
Oh, so this is a validity issue, not an expiration issue, is that right?
Right. Once it's expired, it's against antitrust law.
Thank you. That improves things a little. So let me see if I understand what's going on from what both of you were saying. Company A has a patent on a drug. Company B thinks the patent is invalid. Company B is proposing you bring out the same drug and to litigate with Company A the question of validity.
Yes.
Perhaps Company C is doing this as well. Company A makes a settlement with Company B, in effect. So that's an out-of-court settlement, sounds like, in which Company B say, we agree that we will not challenge the validity of your patent if you pay us $1 million.
Yes.
That's what's going on?
Yes, invalidity or infringement, which are two different analyses.
You will neither infringe and thus force us to...
No litigation.
So that you're not... Is there a procedure for challenging validity at this point if you aren't infringing? Suppose you have a patent on a drug, and I say, well, it's going to cost me a lot of money to bring out a copy of that drug. I don't want to do that if your patent is good. Is there a legal procedure at this point by which I can go to court and ask the court to declare your patent to be invalid before I make the investment to do mine or not?
I believe you can challenge validity at any time.
Once the patent has been granted? I don't know. I'm not a patent lawyer.
I think so.
I think the point is that the Hatch, excuse me, that this, under the Hatch-Waxman Act, I mean, this has been a problem because there's like a paragraph 4 certification they have to do where they have to say that no other patent infringes or invalidates their patent, which are two separate analyses. And they're sort of conflating those when they're checking that box and saying that. But so they're entering into an agreement. So they're never getting to the point where the patent could very well not even be valid. But it's never, the question is never getting to the court system to be litigated. So you have an invalid patent.
But if the patent is valid, then I don't see any point to paying people not to challenge it other than saving a little bit of lawyers.
There's that risk.
company, you don't know if it's read, if it's valid or not.
Well, there was always a risk in court if it found it valid. Yeah. The company took a monopoly and say $10 million worth of gain, but yet the generic has only $1 million to gain. A great monopoly. And the huge loss to the big company, or the system, spent $2 billion to buy up the generic.
And I guess one of the questions then, which is relevant to the question whether anybody can challenge that, is why don't they have to buy off a million generics? That is to say, why can't you now say, well, I observed that they paid...
Paragraph 4 challenge,
yep.
Then you get 180-day as the first generic challenger exclusivity period. That's the main period where you get most of your money as the generic.
So, let me see if...
And only if you're the first, but if you settle... 10 cents loss for all of the generics.
As it sounds as though you actually understand this stuff, so can you explain a little bit more clearly to the rest of us? Here is a sequence. I have patented a drug.
All right.
You are a company that is thinking about making a copy of that drug because you suspect maybe your patent is invalid.
Okay.
Before you start trying to infringe, is there a legal process by which you could challenge my patent?
Anyone can challenge validity at any time, but if the patent has been granted, there's a presumption.
This all happening after the patent has been granted, hasn't it, or is it? Or is it before the patent has been granted?
Well, the path that I don't think has been taken is just going to be abbreviated system with the patent. And through there, you have to say that your patent is non-infringed and does...
This is the original. You're talking now about the original patent.
Say if you're generic entering into a particular market,
you don't need a patent. You need FDA approval, but you don't need a patent to be a generic because you're entering something.
You don't need the patent, but you need to have not infringed.
So that's right. So I have been granted a patent. Is that what's going on? I've been granted a patent, and you are considering bringing out the same drug, infringing my patent, and then trying to persuade a court that my patent's invalid. Is that the story you're telling or not?
Well, in order to get through the FDA, I have to have a drug that's bioequivalent to yours and has the same active ingredients as yours.
Right.
So I have to come out with basically the same drug and then say my drug is not violating the patent.
So is it only at that point that the court gets to decide whether my patent is valid?
That's my knowledge.
So you have to...
No, I think, if he is a generic, he's making the claim that your patent is not infringed because your patent is actually going to go off its term. So there is no question...
No, I thought we were talking about a patent that hasn't expired yet. I thought all of this was about preventing charges, preventing challenges to validity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand. So
patent has to be defeated in court.
Well, we're also just waiting for the patent to expire.
Yeah.
That's the other way to do the generic. But if you want to defeat it in court, can you try to defeat it in court before you actually are infringing? Or does the court only get to the question at the point when they're suing you for infringement?
You still need to make a claim under paragraph 4
argument. I don't understand why you can't just go to the post-grant review and just say words. Yeah.
Under
the AAA.
We all agree about post-grant review.
So it's very good. Explain it to those of us who aren't familiar with it. What?
It's part of the American Invents Act, so now after a patent has been issued, you can take it to post-grant review and try and challenge the invalidity. Before the AIA, you were required to actually bring either a lawsuit for declaratory judgment that a patent was invalid, or be accused of infringing the patent by the industry.
So even before that, you could ask for a declaratory judgment. That's what
you
I wanted.
Could, yeah. It was more.
Because then what I don't understand is in these payment things, why once you've paid him not to challenge your patent, why doesn't he use an enterprise and say, well, I'd like another $50 million too, or I'll challenge it. And why doesn't she say, I'd like another $50 million? And she say, what is the limit that makes it possible to, why is there only one guy you have to buy off, or only two, or only three?
I don't know.
I want to make sense of all of this. Yeah.
Isn't that the name of the game, that only certain people have the facility to actually compete with you?
If all I have to do is to challenge your patent's validity, I don't have to have facilities to compete with you.
Patent litigation is ridiculously expensive. I mean, just getting through, I think our patent litigation professor said just getting through the discovery was well over $500,000.
That's fine, but if it's equally expensive for all 20 of you, then what good does it do him to buy off the first three?
The post-grant review is a lot cheaper than patent litigation.
Yeah, but even before the Fed, that I gather this business of buying people off happened before the American Vet Acts, right? So it's been something for a while. And I'm just trying to make sense. We're out of time anyway. But so the third paper may or may not be Tuesday. I have to look at the papers and figure out what ones go together now that the two that were closest together have happened. All right.
Can I give you an updated version of
the paper?
That would
be nice. Okay. Yeah.
My understanding is that was a rough draft.
It was supposed to be a draft reading. We discussed
it. I'm sorry.
So
would you suggest folks focusing on the Lattice
focusing on whatever you have something to say about, I haven't figured that out
yet. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's part of what I was trying to get at.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll try to get that to you. Thank you.